point of this particular seminar, and the reason why it's the first one, first cab off the rank, as it were, is because we come from very diverse disciplines and different faculties. And historically, this is a pretty radical sort of thing to attempt to do. Short of the union, I was thinking Keiko, but there have, or women at UTS, there haven't been very many forums within UTS for academics to actually talk to each other. And when we said, okay, what do we have in common? And this notion of civil society is the thing that many of us are passionate about, but of course we mean different things by it. So we thought, okay, we need, let alone cosmopolitanism, I'm not even going to try and touch that. I'm just looking at civil society. What is it? And I thought, okay, and James will, I think, follow up with a very different take on it, and that's fine, because what we're saying is that what we in cosmopolitan civil societies are about, engaging with each other and with very different ideas and thinking about some of these core concepts. But I suspect, nonetheless, there, we do have a lot in common. For example, a commitment to social justice, which Jock's already alluded to. But civil society, like most concepts in social science, is highly contested. And it is possible to develop an argument with respectable international citations to demonstrate either that it is central to democratic society or equally that it's at best meaningless and at worst a dangerous and misleading concept. And that in itself, of course, is interesting and something worth exploring. Why the different concepts? Where do they come from? What's their historical roots? How are they used? In what political context? What I want to argue, where I'm personally coming from, and I'm not trying to give you many citations, but what I want to argue is that civil society is as core to understanding society as is the market or the state. In fact, it represents a third leg of all social formations. We are all, at one level, part of the state and its reach. Equally, we are all part of the market and its reach. So too, we are all part of civil society and its reach. However, I would also argue that civil society represents a certain non-commensurability in terms of its ideals, and as such, particularly if this non-commensurability goes unrecognised, it may be used in contexts that are inappropriate, or may be used to argue a position that renders civil society vulnerable to abuse or misuse. So to start with, in positive terms, what I think civil society is, taking a common definition, the one, for example, used by the London School of Economics Civil Society Research Centre. And that's why I wanted you to have this, so I don't have to read it all the way through. But very quickly, refers to the arena of uncoerced collective action around shared interests, purpose and values. In theory, it's, well, rather than read it, you can read it for yourself. There are several aspects of that definition that I would emphasise. First, it's about voluntary action of citizens as citizens, not as customers, nor as subjects of state authority. It's where the initiative comes from citizenship. Secondly, it's an arena of action, one that may but does not necessarily require formal organisations to act. That is, civil society includes the collective action of informal networks just as much as that of formal organisations. Both are important. But for this reason, because the forms are so diverse, the forms of collective are often opaque to scientific gaze. Thirdly, civil society is distinct. Its point of origin, if you like, is distinct from both state and market and represents an acknowledgement that any analysis that rests solely on either state or market, which is most of social theory in the past 50 years, is actually leaving out half the story. Fourth, while distinct, in its own right, civil society necessarily is influenced by and attempts to influence the other sectors. It does not operate in a vacuum. It has fuzzy boundaries. And finally, the other important point is that civil society was originally conceived in most of the early work in its relationship to the nation state. Increasingly, however, just as both the market and the suprastate are increasingly global in orientation and consequence, so too has global civil society become increasingly important on a global scale. Okay, so much for the definition. What to me is important about civil society, and I guess why I'm interested in it, is that I see it as having three primary purposes or functions, if you want to be functionalist. First, it is there to provide a collective response to resist the unjust, to defend social justice, to resist the perceived or to act against the perceived negative effects of the action by the other sectors. So, social activism, advocacy, any kind of opposition or action, resistance function. It involves collective action to impede or obstruct the action of corporations and of states. Most civil social movements are of this sort, at least in their initial stage of formation. Most demonstrations and acts of civil disobedience are also of this form. So, for example, when we get word from CACO to go out and march against the industrial relations laws, that's what we're doing. It's within that function. Secondly, it's collective action to actually solve a social problem. This is a very creative form of collective action, usually designed, it's not just a resistance, but it's actually a problem-solving function designed to address a perceived need which both the state and the market have failed to adequately address. So it's a failure, market failure, state failure. Indeed, almost all modern institutions, I would argue, which we regard as positive attributes of society, such as schools and hospitals, had their origin in this way. Once established, once their efficacy is demonstrated, they may be absorbed by the state or less often by the market. And thirdly, and this is where my personal research is focused, I think a less obvious but perhaps deep down more important purpose is the enactment of social capital. Collective action has the effect of maintaining citizen involvement in their communities of interest and of place, and may serve, as in Scandinavian countries in particular, as recognised schools of democracy. Such engagement by citizens has various desirable consequences, such as improved health and well-being, reduced crime, the potential to address a collective emergency, and so on. There are several problems with this. One is that civil society is unstable over time. It is not stable. Any collective action is capable of generating considerable power, people power. People power is our form of power. Such power, once harnessed, is capable of changing governments, as we know, and modifying corporate and political policy. Such collective action is therefore a target of co-option or manipulation by the other sectors, either in order to preempt or forestall resistance, or else to co-opt into the hegemonic interests of other players. The very act of accepting funding, for example, is likely to weaken the capacity of civil society to maintain its collective action that is independent of the state or the market. A worse problem is the consequence of success. A social movement begins, for example, with a clear vision for action, begins in direct opposition to prevailing hegemonic social forms. It's oppositional and confrontational. It seeks to gain public attention and approval, to bring attention to prevailing unjust policies. An important example of my own experience was the women's movement of the 70s, and in particular, the struggle to name domestic violence as an oppressive form of patriarchal practice for women. As part of the push for public recognition of the problem, women established houses of refuge for fellow women fleeing domestic violence. Those early refuges had a distinct political agenda. They were unfunded and oppositional to mainstream family policy. The early refuge movement was highly successful in bringing the national and international spotlight to bear on this widespread social and political issue. The women who started it, however, wanted not only to bring as a resistance, they wanted to go the second function, which was to solve the problem or to help address it. So the number of women's refuges rapidly increased to meet the growing demand. At first, they were unfunded. The rules of running the houses were made by the women themselves, including the women residents. However, with the success of the movement came state funding. As funding increased, so too did the quality of the facilities and the salary of the workers. However, with the funding came increasing demands from the state for detailed accountability, not only for the use of the funding, but for how the refuges were run and by whom. Collective action was replaced by formal governance structures and professional employment of workers. It could well be argued that the women's refuge movement was successful in its initial aims, but in the process became co-opted into the state agenda. So do women's refuges still remain a part of the collective action of civil society, or have they become simply another agent of the state? This is the problem of non-commensurability for civil society. I reckon it is not possible to both maintain active resistance or opposition to prevailing hegemonic authority and at the same time to be part of the new creative forms of action that will address the original problem. They can occur in sequence, as in the women's refuges, or as in, for example, Greenpeace. They can occur sometimes at different points within the same organisation, often then leading to internal conflict within the organisation. But to maintain ongoing resistance for the sake of resistance does not achieve any concrete new social forms, only endless disruption of the old. To create concrete new social forms is to necessarily disengage from tactics of disruption, to engage in dialogue and negotiation with powerful stakeholders. And that leaves open the possibility, in fact, the likelihood, of some sort of co-option. The purpose is no longer one of social change, but now becomes one of social maintenance. Is it still civil society? Some would say not. I would say it has shifted to other functions, but still retains, we hope, the capacity for dissent and critique, provided only it maintains its independence from both state, market, and the family. For a healthy society, we require the possibility of collaborative forms and partnerships with state and market, but we also need to maintain that loose and open forum for the emergence of new creative forms of resistance. And I think that's what our agenda is in our new centre.